to season 8. Mike, we're at season 8 of Mentioned in Dispatches. Can you believe it?
I can't believe it. Feels like it, though.
I'd have thought after season 1, people would have quit listening to us, but we can't make them go away. So maybe we'll try harder to chase them off. In any event, here we are with the premiere of season 8 of Mentioned in Dispatches. Here with the Armchair Dragoons, you've already heard the semi-irregular, almost permanent co-host, Mike. Welcome, Mike.
Glad to be here, as always.
And the guy who seems to show up for about half of each season, our buddy Aardwolf, is here. Gary, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I tend to make it up in terms of minutes spent talking, however.
Yeah. I think you're going to for the Howard Stern of wargaming here, the king of all media, right?
If there's a multi-million dollar contract in it, then sure, I'll go for that.
We're going to get you your own wargaming movie instead of private parts. It'll be like Private Chits or something.
Well, we have done shows on Hookers and Blow at this point, so.
I actually got that book for Christmas, Hookers and Blow Save Christmas. Don't know if you've seen it.
I have not.
Oh, it is awesome. We will link it to this episode. It is a Hookers and Blow are a tow truck and a snowblower truck. And so Hookers and Blow Save Christmas, drawn as a kid's book. It is not for kids. It is quite amusing, but it is not a kid's book at all. Gary's all over the place these days because he's on YouTube. We've now got him on podcasts. He occasionally shows up on written things. And for the three people left on the planet that have not heard, Aardwolf has dethroned our boy Cyrano as the reigning Grognard of the year from No Enemies Here. So congrats to you for that.
Yes, and thank you to both of the voters.
Yeah. Which sometimes is all you need, right? If you get two votes and no one else shows up, you win.
I guess so.
So
makes the recounts a whole lot easier.
All of those bamboo ballots that were shipped in from overseas.
The hanging chads.
Yeah. What's great about tonight's episode is we're going to let Gary and Mike do all the talking. And by that, Mike's going to ask questions and Gary's going to do most of the talking. But our plan tonight is we're going to open this season with something that we don't normally talk about a lot, in part because it's not a great area of my interest. And since I'm usually the host on these things, it's not something I circle back around to very often. But the American Civil War is still a very popular topic in wargaming, not just in the history of the wargaming hobby, but even contemporary gaming. There's a lot of Civil War stuff out now and more coming every time you turn around. And you'd have thought at some point we would have exhausted the things we have left to explore about the American Civil War. But no, we keep finding more stuff to game with the American Civil War. And so with that in mind, Gary, just out of curiosity, because you're the biggest of the three of us in terms of your Civil War gaming fandom, what is it that keeps people coming back to the American Civil War as a topic that we just can't get enough of it? Is it the fact that, 200 years later, we're still fighting it?
Well, I don't think that's particularly a factor. I think certainly there has been a degree of romanticization around the American Civil War in the United States specifically. But this has also bled over into places like Canada and even Europe, right? I mean, one of the YouTube channels that I've watched religiously for years is Gilbert Collins, who has done, probably 40 videos on different Gettysburg games alone, and he happens to be Canadian, right? So, they're in North America here. Some of those battles didn't necessarily take place all that far from them. The other thing is that unlike, say, if I'm interested in the Napoleonic period, then, it greatly benefits me to be able to read French, for example, or German or Russian. And I can't, and most Americans can't either. All of our histories about the American Civil War are in English. It's easy to find stuff on the American Civil War. If I go to one of the five half-price books that we have here in Columbus, Ohio, they are likely to have one or two, and they have a pretty big, they have like two big bays of sections of history books, okay? In that entire section, there's quite a bit of World War II stuff. But if I'm looking for like Napoleonic War stuff, I'm going to find probably an average of two or three different books that they'll have at any particular given time. And if I go to Barnes & Noble, then the average is probably going to be zero on the Napoleonic period. And again, World War II is much more popular.
Yeah.
But if I go back to the American Civil War, then I've got like almost that entire American history section is friggin' Civil War stuff, right?
You got multiple shelves.
There's, yeah, they'll have, you know, multiple shelf sections of Civil War books. Whereas if I'm interested in something other than World War II, even World War I, right? Half price books will typically have about a half a shelf to a shelf of stuff on World War I. Whereas there's a huge wealth of material on the U.S. Civil War written in English by people who spoke English, and some of it very well written.
Yeah, yeah. I recall going to a bookstore in Baton Rouge one time. A lot of my dad's family's from Baton Rouge, so been there a lot, visited a lot. And there was a really good bookstore down a couple of blocks away from LSU. And it wasn't your typical college bookstore, you know, lots of textbooky kinds of stuff. This was one of those cool, classic local bookstores that has a lot of local flavor and character, but carries a lot of big stuff and is comparable in its inventory to most of your normal size Barnes & Noble's kinds of bookstores. And the American Civil War section there was an entire shelf, like floor to ceiling, 10 feet wide. And it was funny because each one, you'd walk around the store and they've always got labels on the shelves, right? Telling you what's in them. So here's the American Civil War shelf or the American Revolution shelf. Here's the World War I shelf. You're over in the self-help area. Here's the religious section for self-help stuff. Here's the Freudian self-help, whatever. And the American Civil War, there was a giant sign up top that was American Civil War something or other, and every one of the shelves had a different label. There was the American Civil War, the War of Southern Independence, the War of Northern Aggression, and towards the bottom there was one that was just in all caps. It was the War, W-A-H-R. I always got a kick out of the fact that there were that many different names for the same war, just depending on how sarcastic you felt like being. So,
I did a cursory search on Board Game Geek for games listed on Board Game Geek with the word Gettysburg in the title. Now, you understand, of course, that not every game on Gettysburg has the name Gettysburg in the title.
Oh, yeah.
There are 101 games with Gettysburg in the title.
Yeah.
And I would venture to say that all of them are war games, at least in some measure, even if some of them might be super duper abstract. Remember that the very first commercial war game in the modern era, depends exactly how you tabulate this, I believe, but you know, we say that the very first modern war game on a specific historical battle was Avalon Hill's Gettysburg in 1958.
Yeah, yeah. Because the tactics games were hypothetical, the abstract, fictional, fanciful, whatever's.
Yeah, and remember, the Civil War was less than 100 years ago in 1958, too.
Yeah, yeah. There were living veterans of the conflict still floating around.
Yeah, there probably were a couple.
Yeah, yeah. Some 14-year-old drummer boy somewhere that was in his 90s at that point. So it's not a topic that holds great interest in me, in large part because the gunpowder era, the muskets and sabers era is not something that I have a great fascination with. So it's not just the American Civil War. I'm not usually likely to play a Napoleonic something either unless I get dragged into it because that's the only thing I've got available at the moment.
Because Jim has a pistol.
Yes, yes. I've played a couple of Austerlitz games after the ass whooping that Velker handed me. I hope to never play an Austerlitz game again because that boy's kicked my ass every time I've tried. You know, again, it's not just that I'm not a big fan of American Civil War. I'm not a fan of any of those gunpowder era games by and large, but I can appreciate the fact that a lot of people get a lot of enjoyment out of it. And so I don't want to just blow it off as a podcast topic because it's not something I care about. It's something that other people care about. I want to give folks a chance to sort of chime in and weigh in on that, find what it is of interest to them. And so, Mike, what about for you? In obviously, you've got a significant collection of American Civil War stuff going. You might want to punch and play a few of them every now and then, but talk to us a little bit about your fascination with it some.
Yeah, I may. And now that Gary's mentioned that there's 100 games out there with Gettysburg in the title, I don't own 100 Civil War games. So, you know, it's like he said, I think part of the fascination with Civil War is it's an American thing. And it's, you know, especially where I live, I'm surrounded by Civil War battlefields. It's not like I can go, you know, see a Napoleonic battle in Montgomery, Alabama, but I can go see, you know, Civil War battles within driving distance of me. So it's accessibility for sure. That's a big draw, you know, and to me, I do like the musket period. And I think this, you know, you're getting kind of the twilight era of musketry warfare. It's just, I find the battles, some of the battles fascinating, and it's just interesting to replay some of those battles, you know, to see if maybe they could have gone differently.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Bridget Antietam tends to become a bit of a bullet magnet, no matter how you try to play that game. Right. I think that's one that you're just sort of stuck with, kind of the point at which you choose to fight at Antietam, it's just kind of a bad idea. And so if you want to really change Antietam, you've got to go up from the tactical to the operational scale and go somewhere else.
Kind of. Antietam's a tough battle to model, actually. One of the reasons why we've seen so many war games on Gettysburg is relatively easy to model. It starts as a very small engagement between Harry Heath's division and Buford's division, and escalates over the course of 3 days into this kind of apocalyptic battle, right? At any point, one of those two armies could have just said, I've had enough, I'm going to withdraw. That's really, Antietam's more complicated than that. There's a lot of command problems that happen at Antietam, especially, you know, with our typical punching boy, George McClellan. and for that reason, I mean, how do you model McClellan's incompetence on the field at Antietam? You have to have a game mechanic to deal with that. And different games have dealt with that in different ways. For example, I mean, I think we probably all know something about the situation at Gettysburg. For example, the Antietam game from Worthington just models it by saying these are the specific points of the battlefield that you get victory points for: the Sunken Road, Burnside's Bridge, the Dunker Church, places like that. So you are forced to fight over that ground. So it is a sort of key hex type of mechanic. There are other ways to manage that. Another Antietam game that I've played is None But Heroes, which is a Dean Essig design. So, of course, it's got written orders, right? Well, you have to not just write those orders. You have to roll to have those orders received. So if you write an order from McClellan, for example, it may be six turns before the order finally gets out and somebody accepts it and then can act on it.
A question on that, not to drive us off into too much of a rabbit hole on that one, though. In terms of that orders delay and orders communication, it's not like that's a McClellanism, though, right? I mean, that's just the American Civil War. It takes time for you to walk across the battlefield and relay somebody's command to go do something different.
That's the mechanic, but the issue, the number that McClellan specifically has to roll in that game to successfully issue the order is really low.
Okay. Okay.
So McClellan is McClellan's indecisiveness on the day of Antietam is modeled in the system.
Gotcha. So if a more competent commander had been present, the mechanic would still be applicable, but the modifiers would be different.
Well, he was present. Joe Hooker was not in charge.
Well,
so
had a more competent commander been in charge at Antietam, perhaps is the better way to phrase that. So,
yeah.
Well,
but I mean, that's a classic Civil War modeling problem, though, right? Because so many Civil War games or so many Civil War battles and campaigns have that kind of something like that happens. There is some kind of command inefficiency that really skews the battle one way or the other. And in Antietam, it actually happened once on both sides. Robert E. Lee's orders were found in a field wrapped around a packet of cigars, right? So McClellan knew Lee's entire battle plan going into the battle, which you know, makes his indecisiveness hard to consider. But then again, he was also being told by the Pinkertons that he was outnumbered 2-1.
So this brings up an interesting question, though. Again, another one of those rabbit holes before we drag this too far back on topic. But if the intent of you playing the war game is, hey, can I do better than these guys did historically? Am I, you know, a more competent commander with what I can bring to the battlefield than the guys who fought the battle at the time? Why would you want to model McClellan's incompetence when the whole point is for you to prove that you're more competent than the
Well, that's a good question. Is that I'm going to throw that back in your face, though, and say, is that the motivation for playing a game like that? It is certainly for some people, but I don't think it's the case for everybody. Some people want to experience the decision space that the existing, that the historical commanders existed in, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of closer to my own approach to a game like that. So it's not so much that I'm trying to compare myself or contest against the historical counterpart so much as that I am trying to put myself in his head and force myself to deal with the constraints that he was forced to deal with.
Yeah. And it, part of the problem you run into though, there is that you mentioned, you know, the Pinkertons are telling McClellan that he's outnumbered 2-1, except that you're looking at a map where you clearly are not outnumbered 2-1, because in wargaming, we've got that God's eye view that says, oh, hey, here's the count, all the available counters. I mean, again, we've talked about this plenty of times on other podcasts in the past. As soon as you crack the shrink wrap, you know what the available forces for the enemy are, right? I mean, you can't add markers to the game that weren't printed and boxed with the game. So, you know, the entire universe of possibilities of what Lee can have at Antietam are in that box, you know, and it's, yes, it's not going to get any better. It's not going to get any bigger. So there are some things in that decision space that I don't think are possible to be modeled to the level of fidelity that I think some commanders would prefer in their wargaming. It's just the limitation of the medium itself.
It's up to the designer to make the decision about what they want to model about the topic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but I guess it depends on what the player wants to play too, because it's, you know, how much are you limited to what you can do in one of these games? In fact, it was a few years back, I think it was just a couple of years back, they released a game called Pickett's Charge. And I remember, I don't own the game, and I can't say anything about it other than when I saw it, Pickett's Charge, I was like, you know, how many outcomes can there be to Pickett's Charge? So why in the world would I want to buy a game on Pickett's Charge knowing exactly what's going to happen? So in something like that, you know, how much wiggle room do you have to change history or to even make it slightly different outcome than what actually happened there? So, you know, again, like you said, it's a rabbit hole we could go down with this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think in some cases it's an issue of, I think for some seemingly overly predetermined outcomes, it's how do you compare against the historical outcome, right? The Texans are not getting out of the Alamo. They're just not. I mean, it's so can you hold out an extra 5 days than they historically did against the Mexican army?
Right.
You know, or can the Mexicans overwhelm them faster, depending on which side you're playing on? Now, again, you know, Gary, to your point, it may not be comparing yourself against the historical outcome. It may be exploring that decision space. That's totally fine.
And that's going to guide my selection of topics that I'm into, too. Right. I'm unlikely to play a game about the Alamo because it's a. Because exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Do they hold out for an extra 5 hours this time? Yay. I mean, I don't know that that's an interesting situation. I think you could make a decent solitaire game out of it? Yeah, I think actually you could, but that doesn't mean there's an interesting decision space there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a States of Siege game on the Alamo.
Yeah. And so I've just looked at Pickett's Charge as we're talking here, and it turns out that is a solitaire game. And it's pretty highly rated. Pretty highly rated.
Yes, it is. It's supposed to be quite good.
Yeah. I think
there's a similar game using the same system on Point du Hoc.
Yeah. Yeah. The Day of the Rangers game. And they're all Herman design. They're all Herman Lettman designs, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think so.
It's almost the war game, not to be overly reductionistic about it. It's almost war game Chutes and Ladders, right? You're trying to get to the other end of the map and survive while doing so.
It would be worth discussion.
Operation perhaps. Crowbar, I think, is the Point du Hoc.
Yeah, it is. It is Crowbar. I think it would be a worthwhile topic for discussion, perhaps not tonight, for discussing the ability of solitaire games specifically to model really one-sided conflicts.
Yeah, yeah. That almost sounds like a counter-clipping stream.
Yeah, probably not. But, somebody could get some mileage out of that.
Well, let's be honest. You'd get 10 minutes into it, and then you'd be off topic on something else.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. I think that question deserves a more in-depth treatment than I'm going to give it while clipping counters and swilling down scotch.
Fair enough.
Speaking of which, we are recording this on Burns Day, so I am drinking scotch.
We shall bank that and come back to it at a future podcast topic and perhaps invite Gary back to help explore it even. One of the things, Gary, you mentioned 101 games with Gettysburg in the title, and we know that that's not all the Gettysburg games out there. because I think In Magnificent Style is a Gettysburg game, right?
As is Terrible Swift Sword, which is not on this list.
Yes. So there are no shortage of not... I think it's fair to say that all of the games with Gettysburg in the title are, in fact, about Gettysburg.
I believe that's a safe assumption. There is a handful of very well-known Gettysburg games that are not on this list, like Terrible Swift Sword, Fateful Lightning's not on this list.
Yeah.
There's some other ones as well.
A while back, I had written a column about why we keep going back to some of the same conflicts over and over, and some of the more well-known ones, right? And we can all rattle them off the top of our head. You know, there's D-Day, there's Waterloo, Stalingrad, Gettysburg. You know, we've got these down. The Bulge, we pretty much know what all of these are, and we're pretty comfortable putting those in that top 10 of most wargamed topics. One of the reasons why I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing is when you're exploring Gettysburg, we all know what the key terrain of Gettysburg is, right? We all know the Peach Orchard matters. We all know Little Round Top matters. We all know Culp's Hill matters. Like, there's certain things that we know these things matter. And so as you're exploring the game, it's less about trying to figure out the battlefield, because we've already kind of done that. And it gives you an opportunity to spend a little more time exploring the argument that the designer is making in what they prioritize within their mechanics. And so because we've already cracked the code on the key terrain, on the order of battle and the organization, and perhaps even some of the command challenges and issues as a part of that organization, we can focus more on what we think the designer deems to be important. Is it the command and control piece? Is it technological superiority on one side or the other? Is it the seizure of key terrain? Is it artillery support of infantry? Is it whatever the case may be? In your explorations of Gettysburg games, have you run across something that really gets completely off the wall with kind of a lot of the traditional modeling of the battle itself? Or is it one of those, hey, these guys think this particular facet of the battle is more important? You know, the organization was more important than the technical piece, or the commanders were more important than the kinds of munitions or whatever.
So that's really kind of the thesis of the design, right? It's the designer's statement, whether they decided consciously that they were making a statement or not, they did, about what was important at the particular battle, whether it's Gettysburg or the Bulge or whatever. I would submit, by the way, that most games that have Stalingrad in the name are not actually about Stalingrad. Stalingrad just happens to be a point on the map, but that's another show too.
Yeah.
But Gettysburg specifically is, you know, to put this in an American Civil War context, I think everybody has a certain amount of familiarity with the terrain of Gettysburg. It is the crossroads, right? Where all these roads intersect. And when you start looking at an operational map of that area, you can see why the battle was fought where it was, because that's where all the roads intersect.
Yeah.
So
kind of like Bastogne, right?
Exactly. That's why Bastogne was a key, you know, it's why it's a key victory hex in every Bulge game, because it's a huge crossroads where like six important roads intersect. But there is a factor of map knowledge that once you get used to it, and you could think of this as understanding the map to the specific game that you're playing, or understanding the terrain that the battle was fought over, but I think the effect is the same either way. What I think you're trying to say is, once you kind of internalize that, you've internalized the order of battle, so you kind of understand that, hey, you know, here's the basic rate at which Confederate troops arrive and Union troops arrive. You can kind of forget all that and just kind of let the battle flow and use the mechanics to explore that thesis statement that the designer is making. So, and again, to turn this back to possibly the most thesis forward designer I can think of off the top of my head is probably Dean Essig, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's very obvious what he wants to emphasize in that conflict model, right? In the case of whatever Civil War Dean Essig design we're talking about, command control, command efficiency is a huge part of that thesis statement. The important things that the important questions that Dean is asking about those conflicts are related to those subjects.
Yeah, yeah. I was getting ready to say, for those that don't know much about Dean, give us that priority, and you rolled right into it. So that was great. saved me from having asked the question before you answered it. So the Gettysburg is one of them. Shiloh, I would argue, is another one of those very well-known, well-understood Civil War battles that, because there are so many different Shiloh games, you have an opportunity to engage more with the designer's thesis and can set aside some of the, I wonder if this piece of terrain is important kinds of questions. Obviously, Antietam's another one.
Antietam is another one. I would be curious to see, actually, like somebody's actual numeric analysis of Civil War battles by number of games dealing with that battle, right? And I'm sure Gettysburg is at the top, and I'm reasonably sure Shiloh and Antietam are number two and number three, but I'd be very curious to see the rest of the list, because there are battles that we have literally never seen a game about, right? Like something like Ball's Bluff. There's been like at least two games on Ball's Bluff that I could think of. So even a lot of, even relatively obscure, Seven Pines and stuff like that, relatively obscure battles that the average person on the street has not heard of, we have seen war games on, like more than one war game on these subjects, even though there remains a lot of smaller battles that we haven't seen a game on. I'd be curious to see that, say, top 10 list of Civil War battles that there have been games about.
That would be interesting. Yeah.
I'm betting there's a bunch of folks that would probably assume Chancellorsville's on the list just because it was one of the first. But I'm wondering if it actually would be one of the
top. You're talking early war games.
Yes. Not one of the first battles, but one of the first war games. If Chancellorsville would actually be on the list, or if people are just making that assumption because it was one of the first war games out there. So
I don't think there's that many games on Chancellorsville. I mean, there's certainly more on Chancellorsville than there is about, you know, North Anna River, for example. But I don't have the sense that Chancellorsville is an incredibly heavily modeled battle.
Yeah.
Vicksburg's I'd be happy to be proven wrong by actual numbers, however.
Yeah. So anybody listening that wants to compile that list, please get in touch with us here at the show, and we are more than happy to help set aside a day for publishing your research over at the Armchair Dragoons. We are more than happy to do that for you. I'm betting Vicksburg's probably in the top 10. Just gut reaction.
Oh, I don't think so. Vicksburg's very difficult to model because it's a siege.
Well, I didn't say it was a fun game to play. I just think because it's...
Well, yeah, but because it's challenging to model a siege in general, right? Not just for the Civil War. I think there have been relatively few games on Vicksburg. So I'd be willing to bet you for a fiver that that Vicksburg is not in the top 10.
I'm not arguing with the guy that actually owns more than one Civil War game. Like, I'm not going to argue with you about that one. If you don't
I don't have the world's most exhaustive Civil War library, but I'm not doing, I don't have a shamefully thin library on the Civil War either.
I'm looking at my shelf. I have GMT's Fort Sumter. That's it.
That's not even a Civil War game. That happens before the Civil War. The game ends and the Civil War starts.
You're proving my point.
And right. even if it did take place after the war started, I'm still not sure that would be a war game.
Yeah, I you guys are proving my point for me here. I'm saying this with that. Was there an American Civil War game in about the first 12 issues of Battles magazine? Because if so, then I might have one in there. But that's I'm not digging through the magazines to see. I'm just looking at the game shelf. And seriously, no shit. Like, Fort Sumter is the closest I get to an American Civil War game. That's it.
So I'm curious, so what is it about the gunpowder era specifically that doesn't, is there something that is actively pushing you away from that era?
Probably some of my own misconceptions about it, but we've talked plenty before, and Gary, this isn't going to come as a secret to you, but you know, Cold War Goes Hot is kind of my sweet spot. That's my era, in part because that's the military I grew up in with my dad serving in it. That's the military I served in when I was in the 90s, because that was pre-GWAT. So it was still very much a Cold War mentality at the time. That's the area that I lived in for a good chunk of my years growing up. I mean, the summer I turned 16 was the summer we moved back to the U.S. after our second tour in Europe. And at that point, I'd spent over half of my life living in Germany. And so that's the era that I'm a lot more interested in part because I lived it, but also at the operational level to an extent, but certainly at the tactical level, I think I find the maneuver challenges more interesting. There are more toys to play with from a maneuver challenge, and the combined arms puzzles to be solved, I find more interesting in the modern era than I do in the gunpowder era. That's not to say there aren't some, I just don't find them as interesting. To me, you kind of hit a wall with, you know, infantry, cavalry, artillery, right? The classic three risk pieces, and then you're sort of out of toys, as opposed to now we're incorporating aviation, and now we're incorporating electronic warfare, and now we're incorporating over the horizon combat effects and whatever. So that's just, those are the kinds of toys I prefer to play with.
So hey, we had balloons in the Civil War. Come on.
That's true. So I think what you're trying to say is Civil War and, you know, the gunpowder era in general has just kind of been squeezed out by a greater interest in more contemporary topics. And B, you're also wrong.
Dude, I've been married over 20 years. I'm used to being wrong. Whether I'm actually wrong or not, I'm just used to being told I'm wrong. So that's fine. Again, like I said, some of this may be my own misconceptions, but that's just sort of my general feeling. You're right. A lot of it has to do with certain topics being squeezed out, because it's not like it's just the gunpowder era that I don't tend to play well with.
It's very difficult, if not impossible, to be literally interested in every single period of historical gaming.
Yeah,
I'm not. I've been very transparent about that. I'm interested in too many periods already, and I'm deeply resistant into getting into additional periods, because I know that then, this Arab-Israeli Wars topic is absolutely fascinating. I must go buy these 6 books and these 18 games on the subject, and I don't have shelf space for that stuff. So I am actively resisting entrenching myself in additional periods of wargaming at this time.
Well,
it's very hard to do that.
Yeah, it sounds like Aardwolf's next crowdfunding campaign is going to be to buy more shelves.
Buy a bigger house. That's so what I need.
So that you can increase your areas of interest for...
Yeah. Then I'll have less money to spend on war games, but then I'll have more space to play the war games. So, you know, it's a trade-off. Yes. Life is full of trade-offs.
It's all a balancing act. So, no, my lack of interest in the gunpowder era, like you said, it largely is that it's been squeezed out by other things. But if I'm going to play a gunpowder era something, I would rather play one at the operational level and above than down at the tactical level, because at a certain point, lines of muskets poking holes in each other just starts to induce, some snoozing from me.
So that's an interesting statement, because there are far more tactical, grand tactical battle scale Civil War games than there are operational games, certainly. And I submit that strategic games as well. In fact, I think there's probably more tactical, grand tactical games than there are operational and strategic put together.
Yeah.
So the consensus appears to disagree with you.
And that's fine.
But that doesn't say anything, that you can't be interested in some specific thing. I mean, I keep saying this, I'm not all that into World War II tactical. And yes, I just got more ASL stuff in this week. But but other than that, I have been very resolute for actually years now about not buying more World War II tactical stuff, because I'm just not that interested in World War II tactical. I've got a comprehensive solution for it. It is sufficient. I'm good.
And I'm betting a good chunk of that ASL stuff you've bought simply to maintain the collection in its relative intactness than you have, because you're necessarily going to try and play them all.
Well, that's not my motivation, though. My motivation, my motivation is, if stuff goes out of print, then it will command 4 to 6 times its retail price. So I might as well buy it now while it's in print, right?
Yeah.
And that's a valid concern, yes.
Bringing us back to Civil War. So, Gary, you mentioned the idea of operational and strategic level Civil War stuff being in short supply relative to a lot of the tactical and grand tactical pieces of it. Any guesses as to why that might be the case?
So they're the big boy in the Civil War operational space is, of course, the Great Campaigns of the American Civil War series, which was started at Avalon Hill by Joe Balkowski and has been carried on by some other folks in Multiman Publishing. Okay. And they're, we're going to get a new GCACW game on pre-order at least this year, and we might even get it in our hands this year, and that'll be great. I think to some extent, the Civil War narratives that we as Americans talk about have not been operational narratives. They have been battle narratives. So a lot of the sort of oral history of the Civil War is talked about and framed in terms of battles. And a lot of the books, like Shelby Foote stuff, is spends a lot more time talking about the battles than about the operational considerations. And I think that's a common feature of the American narrative about the Civil War, whether it's a South-oriented narrative or a Union-oriented narrative. And I think that's part of the reason. Part of the reason is also that the Great Campaigns of the American Civil War is just that damn good. It appears to have kind of cleared the orbit. It has cleared its orbit, right? So yeah. Other competitors to it seem to shine a lot less brightly. There are competitors to it. There's the Civil War campaign series, for example, from Clash of Arms, which some people really do like. It relies heavily on hidden information. There's also the various John Tyson games, a couple of which are from Holland Spiel, and I think a couple of which came out from Tiny Battle Publishing. Those are operational games as well, and I've heard, you know, some positive things about those, but not the, you know, the enormous community of glowingly speaking fans, of whom I am one, that we see around the Great Campaigns of the American Civil War. But the same thing that you just said also applies to Napoleonic. There are relatively few operational Napoleonic game systems as well. There are some, but not that many. There isn't a dominant one that completely dominates that space. But again, the narrative that we talk about is not necessarily about the operational campaigns or the maneuver or the logistics or any of that. It's about the battles.
Yeah, it's interesting that you draw the comparison with the Napoleonic, because one of the questions that I was about to circle back around to is whether or not, let's face it, as it stands now and has largely been constituted throughout the hobby's history, wargaming is primarily an American designer driven and dominated hobby. It's widening. It's good that we're getting more design perspectives from outside the US, but I'm wondering if a lot of those designers hadn't shied away from that strategic level Civil War narrative so as to avoid some of the thornier political discussions that would come with it. I'm wondering if it's that, or if it's possibly just the fact that in its industrial overmatch that eventually the North was going to just bury the South in a war of attrition. The North had more bodies to throw at the problem.
I do think that to some extent our image of the U.S. centricity of the wargaming hobby is a little bit of an illusion. But nevertheless, I mean, it certainly looks like that from my chair as well. I think we're just paying a lot less attention to stuff that's happening in Europe and China and Japan. And there is a lot of wargaming development happening in all of those places.
Well, there is today. I'm not sure that's true over the history of the hobby.
Well, certainly we, you know, the board wargaming hobby got started here, but yeah. Vivictus has been around for ages. Yeah. Right.
I'm happy to be proven wrong.
Azure Wish was publishing stuff in the 90s, right? Yeah. So, I mean, there's a history there too, especially in Europe and, you know, Japan and China.
No, I understand, but keep in mind that I was living in Germany for a good chunk of the 80s, spoke German, lived in German communities, was shopping at German stores, and I'm finding German language translations of Avalon Hill and SPI games, not German publishers publishing games, not German translations of French games. Like, that's...
Well, Germany had that whole thing going on where war games were officially discouraged too. So that could have been a factor, but be that as it may, I don't feel like at any point war game designers have shied away from the U.S. Civil War at a higher level because of politics or political considerations or sensitivity or anything like that. I'm just not buying that.
I would hope not. Again, that's a bit of a gut reaction informed by absolutely zero data. And just
I think that's a legitimate question to ask. I just think that the answer is no. I don't think that's been a particularly significant factor.
Cool.
Yeah, I think the answer is no as well. I agree. Yeah.
Okay, sure. So, Mike, again, you've got a lot of them on the shelf. Of the more contemporary designs, of the more state of the art of what's out there today, what have you pushed counters around on, and what were your opinions of it?
Well, see, that's the thing. I don't have a whole lot of contemporary stuff on the Civil War. Most of my stuff is the older stuff.
You're killing me, Smalls.
It's stuff that, you know, when you go to investigate, like you were talking about Vicksburg. And of course I'm like, I got to go look up Vicksburg games now to see what's actually out there. And you know, most of it's older stuff. There's one that says 2021, but most of this other stuff is, you know, 69 Vicksburg, 85 the road to Vicksburg. As far as newer stuff goes that I actually have that I have not played is the two that I bought, Roads to Gettysburg 2 and Battle Above the Clouds. I own both of those, and I have yet to try them, and they look fascinating.
They are they are fabulous. I have played both.
And what was the other one I bought? So, you know, I did Across 5 Aprils, just finished that up, and I will be starting Battle Hymn, Gettysburg, and Pea Ridge pretty soon. I think that's a newer one, or is that a reprint?
It's sort of both, actually. It's a board game version of the Shenandoah Studios game on Gettysburg, and then it also adds Pea Ridge. So it's new to board gaming, but it's not new. The video game is called Gettysburg, The Tide Turns, I believe, and it's quite nice, actually. It plays well. I'm not as big a fan of the board game, but that's because of, even though they're almost identical, right? The mechanics are all the same, with the single exception of, I don't think you can dismount the cavalry in the video game version. I think that's literally the only difference. So that's absolutely a function of my taste in video games versus my taste in board games about Gettysburg, where I want more detail than that.
Well, in Mike's defense, he did just finish the Across 5 Aprils Ridge game that ran 6 or 7 episodes on My Own Worst Enemy. And I think, Mike, your intent was to compare the two Pea Ridge games, right?
Yeah. And it still is. I still will. It's kind of an updated rules of Across 5 Aprils, perhaps, or it's just a cleanup of some of those rules. I think it's different enough, though, that it's almost a new game. I think it uses a D10 instead of D6s. I think the combat ratio tables has been removed, which I hated, honestly. But and I intend to compare those. You're absolutely right.
I think it's the designer, same designer, right?
It's the legendary Eric
Lee Smith.
Yes.
And it's the same designer's look 30 years later, whatever it's been, at this a similar topic. And I think I'm not a fan of the reductionist categorizations that say, oh, it's the same game because it's the same battle. But I think they're probably different enough to warrant an interesting comparison.
Yeah, I think you said that perfectly. I think that's exactly what I had read. That's what it was. He he's learned a lot in the last 30 years. So, you know, why not apply that to the previous design?
I mean, I was a dipshit 30 years ago.
And then another new game I have is Jeff Davis, The Confederacy at War from Ben Madison, which I have yet to play, but that one's coming up pretty soon for me, I think. And that one certainly, I don't think, shies away from any of the political.
Oh God, no. Ben Madison doesn't shy away from any sensitive political topic. He wades in with the hip waders and you know, kerosene and a blowtorch.
Yeah, right? That's got some nuanced design in it, though. I've got that game, and while I haven't played it, I give it a fairly thorough look. And I was initially very dismissive of it. It's like, oh, this sounds great, right? But there's a lot of nuanced design in there. It's an interesting design. Ben Madison is a designer who is worth following.
Absolutely. And I don't think he's looking to be incendiary or anything at all. I think he's just making games based on history as it's, you know, as we know it. And he's not going to shy away from things that were part of history, well, good or bad.
I think Ben is happy to tackle those more problematic topics, and in doing so, to the level of accuracy that he wants, requires that level of sort of blowtorch and kerosene. Look, he did the same thing with the White Tribe. You know, anybody making a game on trying to help the Rhodesian government survive as long as possible, you know, where that's your goal in the game, is likely to run afoul of all sorts of pearl clutching apparatchiks floating around the web out there. He didn't give a shit, right? He went right at it. And it was a great game. Like, we did a 7-part AAR on the White Tribe on the site, and it's a great game.
I feel I have to say is that nobody's saying you can't make a game on that topic or the Civil War or whatever. Literally, there's nobody saying that. What is being said is, in order for such a game to be worth anyone's time, it has to deal with the subject in a nuanced way, and a way that's also accurate.
Yes.
And the Ben Madison designs, and I haven't seen them all, but the Ben Madison designs that I have seen certainly do so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I applaud Ben Madison for the nuance he can bring to a topic in a world that doesn't believe in nuance. And so I applaud him for doing that, and he does it well. So
we live in a world that believes in 144 characters.
Yeah. If that meant 144 characters, of which 11 at a minimum are going to be emojis. So, Mike, I'm going to be real interested to see what you think of the Jeff Davis game, because it's not one I probably would have picked up even with Ben Madison at the helm, just because, again, it's not a topic I would normally go after.
It's like Gary said, though, honestly, I see Ben Madison's name on the game. It's like, I'm going to buy it, because he's never let me down, you know.
He's let my wallet down several times.
However, he's made a couple of publishers very happy on your behalf, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
On the flip side, I don't know that Ben Madison's ever given your postal carrier a hernia.
No, I don't think so. I think I own about 8 White Dog Games games, and they might actually all be Ben Madison games. Yeah. That's, I'm not 100% on that, but I might be right.
I may not be in the same boat, but I'm certainly close to it myself. Yeah, it's...
That would be an interesting headcount there, just to see, to see where you go. So,
and actually, I just did an unboxing on, he did one called CSA America Civil War, published under Fiery Dragon. And I yet to play that one, but it looks interesting too. It's actually a 2-player game. It's not solo. So it also has that going for it, but it's, big strategic level game.
I was going to ask how close you were to pushing counters around on that one at this point. So,
as the Dragoons proudly charge into their 8th season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we'd like to pause and thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a heartfelt thanks to Treb Curry, Staggerwing, Patrick Mullen, Mike Quigley, Hethwill Wargames, Patrick Garrity, Robert, Kevin Bertram, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Armchair Dragoons and enabling us to bring you the best wargaming content we can. You, too, can sign up as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
So, Mike, you've already played the Across 5 April's P Ridge game. You've got the Battle Hymn P Ridge game coming up also. Are there any other P Ridge games in the future that you're seeing, just for the sake of completeness?
No, I just wanted to compare these two because it was the same designer, Eric Smith. And I was just interested in how, what difference does 30 years make? And I think it's going to be interesting to see that, see what changes have come to the Battle of Pea Ridge. So I think after that, we would have seen enough of Pea Ridge.
I think I have 2 games on Pea Ridge, too, and they're 2 different games. One's Thunder in the Ozarks, and the other one is Pea Ridge from SBI.
Okay, so Gary, this is going to bring up the question, does Pea Ridge belong in that top 10 list that we were talking about earlier in the show?
No, I don't think top 10. Top 25, maybe. I could think of 4 or 5 games on Pea Ridge. I mean, we've just mentioned 4, right? So
yeah, that's why I'm asking. That. Like, we've thrown 4 off the top, just off the cuff here.
Yeah, and I could name another probably 4. So no, I don't think it's top 10, but top 25, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So
it is was called the Gettysburg of the West, at least until Chickamauga happened.
Yeah. Well, does that one go into your top 10?
That one might be in the top 10. Yeah. Chickamauga, which is a fascinating battle, might be in the top 10.
Yeah. So I want to come back around to a topic you had mentioned earlier, Gary, and that is the idea of sort of the command and control aspect and the leadership aspect in the American Civil War. And I think, probably owing some to the American-centric nature of things, probably, the fact that we've got readily available material on a lot of these guys. Is there perhaps a little bit of emphasis on command and control and leadership personalities in Civil War games because they were that big of a deal on the battlefield, or because we have that much material available on which to try and base the research that goes into the games.
I would have trouble saying that I think that command and control is a bigger factor in American Civil War than it is for other periods like Napoleonics, for example. But I mean, certainly the command dynamic changes when you start getting modern conflicts like World War II. And some of it is just that this is a very well-documented period, and it's also filled with relatively colorful characters, right? You know, Robert E. Lee and all the various Confederate generals with their preposterous beards, for example, and Dan Sickles, who assassinated the son or grandson or nephew or whatever it was of Francis Scott Key in a lover's spat and got off because not guilty by reason of temporary insanity. He's literally his case of shooting the son of Francis Scott Key in the chest in absolute public is the origin of the whole not guilty by reason of insanity defense. So, you know, tons of colorful characters on all sides, right? George Thomas, whose family, the Virginian who stayed nevertheless loyal to the Union, the Rock of Chickamauga, whose family never spoke to him again after he betrayed the South, you know? So, you know, there's a lot of interesting personal stories behind these people. And then when you tie it into a game mechanic, you can sort of tie the game mechanic in the form of command control to those people, to those personalities and those characters. Now, that said, there's tons of old games that paid no attention to command and control whatsoever, right? Like, it's not quite true with the old SPI games, but like the old SPI Great Battles of the American Civil War didn't pay much attention to that. Certainly the original versions of Avalon Hill's Gettysburg didn't do that. And the 80s, the one that came out in the 70s is I think the one I'm thinking of that really didn't have much modeling of command control either. So that is a thing that has been largely ignored over like the greater history of wargaming, but certainly not ignored in say the last 20 or 30 years of designs.
Is that just because of the evolution of design?
Because we've already got, you know, Gettysburg 77, where everybody just marches onto the battle and like the only interactive feature of the game is the order of arrival, right? Yeah. We've got a bunch of games like that. So a committed designer is going to look at that space and say, you know, I really think that, you know, the command inefficiencies on the part of, say, Longstreet were decisive in this battle. Let's build a system that models that.
Yeah.
Or the fact that Lee was apparently completely befuddled due to lack of information on the whole first day.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering if, you know, hey, personalities actually matter and maybe we should try to find a way to model it, or, well, shit, we've done everything else. Let's see what we can do with the commanders.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's tempting to sort of anthropomorphize the game mechanics in the form of those colorful historical characters. But I don't know that happened because, you know, we had explored the entire rest of the space necessarily. But that is a thing that started to get explored starting in, say, the early 80s. Is where I would trace it to without exhaustive study of the topic. And that is a thing that, I mean, I'm very, very uninterested in playing games now at any scale that don't model command and control, unless it's for pretty high level strategic, then maybe it doesn't make sense to.
Yeah. Mike, what were you going to say in there?
No, I was just going to say, it's interesting because I was wondering beyond the battlefield, if there's any strategic level games that model behaviors at the political level. There was a computer game that I played years ago called No Greater Glory, The American Civil War by SSI. And it actually, you had to appease senators to take certain actions that you wanted to take and, you know, or
bribes.
Have their state.
You pay them bribes. Come on.
Exactly.
It's called graft. Okay.
But I'm wondering if there's a board game that does the same thing. And I can't think of a single one that would do something like that.
I can. Republic Civil of
War?
Rome.
Oh, okay. Well, I meant Civil War.
Well, Civil War, not that I can think of off the top of my head, but certainly there are those kinds of games. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, I'm just trying to think through some of the political machinations that you could even try to put into a Civil War game that Because look, let's face it, in 1864, there was a very real danger that Lincoln was not going to win re-election, and how some of those political machinations might have played out in the run-up to that election, in the 1862 midterms, in some of what was going on in the Confederacy at the time, in you know, the ways in which the Confederate states, because of their far looser integration than the Union was integrated at the national level, how much of a political game you could get out of all of that, should you care to actually try to put it in place. I suspect not a lot of people are going to have a stomach to tackle much of that in today's environment. But it would be interesting to see. So.
There's a lot less material to draw from when you're talking about the political space inside the context of the American Civil War. There's just so much more material on the battles, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't think there I think we probably don't have anybody working on something like that, just because it's kind of hard to nail that down, right? I mean, Fort Sumter is another great example, right? It's a dimension of the conflict, even though it happens before that and isn't a real Civil War game. But it's a dimension of that conflict that it has been sort of overshadowed by the more attractive narrative of the battles and the campaigns, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the very high political level of, you know, Lincoln and, you know, his interactions with various highly placed people in his administration and some of like the top senators. I mean, if you've watched like the movie Lincoln, you'll get a sense of that, right?
I'm wondering to what extent the accessibility of the battlefields themselves helps create or maintain interest in Civil War wargaming, primarily here in the U.S., right? Not a lot of dudes flying over here from Germany just to go walk around Chancellorsville, but, you know, maybe there are a couple. However, there's plenty of folks here in the U.S. that if they're that interested, they could drive over there and go walk around, go visit the battlefield. You know, Gettysburg's been a national park for a long damn time.
Yeah, but parts of that battlefield are developed now, right? You know, yes. There's like a, you know, it's one of the important parts there's of that battlefield. There's a gas station now. And American Civil War battlefields exist in various states of preservation, right? In some cases, they're very well preserved and very close to what they looked like in 1862 or 1864 or whatever. And in other places, not so much. You can go see, yeah, there's a, you know, there's a statue somewhere, but that you can go get a sense of part of the terrain, but a lot of the battlefield has been developed into subdivisions now.
Yeah.
So it really does depend on which battle. But there certainly are plenty of, if you just want the experience of going to see a Civil War battlefield, it's not that hard to get one, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot that you can go see and at least get a sense of what that terrain looked like.
Yeah, the last one I walked was New Market, and I guarantee you it looks identical to the way it did back when the battle took place.
Did you walk on the field of lost shoes?
I did. I kept my shoes, though.
I bet you did. It's very uncomfortable walking on that ground with no shoes.
I have not watched that movie, though. It's supposed to be a very good movie.
I haven't either.
Does someone want to explain for the members of the audience that may not know, what is the field of lost shoes?
I'll let Mike tackle this one.
Well, so it was a group of VMI cadets that were charging across this open field towards Union lines, and it was rainy, and the ground was muddy and gross, and as they ran, their boots got stuck in the mud and stayed there as they continued their charge. That's as good as I'll do.
And there's because a movie called The Field of Lost Shoes about it.
Yes.
Somewhere in there, there's a joke about cadets not knowing how to lace up their shoes. So
if there is, I'm not going to make it.
I mean, they're Confederate cadets, so I don't even know if they had shoes.
Yeah, I'm just making fun of cadets at military schools kind of across the board, because as a regular ROTC dude that did not attend one of those military schools, that's kind of what we do. We make fun of those people because they're easy to make fun of. So
I guess one other question I would throw out, and maybe Gary would know the answer, maybe Brent, even though he said he doesn't like the Civil War. Is there a strategic, an overall grand Civil War game that makes an effort to try to connect with the well-known tactical battles? And honestly, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I mean, you have the map, you have the locations, the cities are there. But I mean, is there anything that tries to recreate a Gettysburg or a Vicksburg or any of these battles?
but that's nevertheless a strategic level game.
Yes.
I would want to go back and look at the locations on the map for A House Divided and see how many of those correspond to key battles somewhere.
And you'd almost have to have an area movement map, I think, to do this, right?
Well, so A House Divided is a giant point-to-point map. It almost looks, I mean, it predates Paths of Glory by 30 years, but it kind of looks like the Paths of Glory map. That's the one that comes to mind off the top of my head that might actually have a bunch of those locations as key nodes in the point-to-point network.
Yeah, and certainly For the People has there are definitely points on the point-to-point map before the people that you absolutely will fight battles over if the game proceeds in anything remotely resembling the historical process of the war, where there were big battles, Forts Henry and Donelson, for example, that you'll have to, unless the Union player is going to ignore the Western Theater, which is dumb, then you're going to have to take those points. So you're going to have to fight over them.
That's the type of map I think you'd have to play on for something like that.
Now, on the other hand, I mean, I think you do see those kinds of battles happen in, say, the Victory Game Civil War, which is another Eric Lee Smith design, which is a hex-to-hex map, but you might not see those battles happening on the exact same locations than you would historically. In fact, I'm not sure if it's the Eric Lee Smith Civil War or the Mark Simonich U.S. Civil War that doesn't have Shiloh on the map. Maybe both of them, actually. Now that I'm thinking about it.
Civil War. I've pre-ordered U.S. Civil War, but it is yet
to arrive. It's good game.
Although I did just get, I just saw somewhere on the internet that, this is getting off topic, but the Pacific War from GMT. Yep. The Pacific War from GMT is getting ready to ship, and it weighs 10 pounds.
Yep, so. It does. So
can't wait to see that.
And Gary's got two on the way.
Yes, I do.
Oh, geez.
And two Vietnams. Those are 5 pounds. So, but Manassas Junction is another one where you will end up fighting in over that hex in U.S. Civil War and the Eric Lee Smith Civil War. You could tie that, and maybe you don't have the exact same mix of historical commanders at those battles, but maybe you have a very similar mix of commanders at those battles too. So I've certainly seen it played out that way. And typically there will be a big battle out in Tennessee that, you know, is a Shiloh-like battle as well, even if it doesn't necessarily resemble the specific tactical situation of Shiloh.
Right. Yeah. And in the computer world, again, I know that Matrix put out Forge of Freedom, where you may not have those battles in the specific locations, but you would have big tactical battles if you played them out. And because they actually had where it would break out into a tactical battle and you could control all the individual units, but you would have these grand battles in certain areas.
Yeah. The difference with Forge of Freedom is that it was built with both engines in place. It was built with the strategic level engine that's almost more of a 4X game in its production management requirements. And then you had the actual tactical battles that, if I recall correctly, you had the option to toggle either one off if you only wanted to worry about the other.
Although yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't swear to that. I think that was the case. It was the same team that did Crown of Glory that did the Napoleonic, multi-level game as well. Obviously, well, really hard to do in a board game environment. Really hard.
No, because what I would do is take one of my big strategic games, and whenever, two armies come to fight, I'd break out Command and Colors, Battle Cry, or one of those games, and just play the battle out on that, and then go back to the strategic game.
Yeah, the problem you would run into, of course, is what happens.
I would never finish, is the problem.
Instead of meeting in Shiloh, they meet 10 miles down the road, north or south of Shiloh. You don't have a map for that because there was never an actual Civil War battle there, and so now you're back to winging it.
Battle Cry, right? It's just a blank map. You don't need really the, you've just got the terrain you can move around. So that's easy enough to do.
Yeah. I did pull up the House Divided game on Board Game Geek and just tried to look in at a couple of the maps. So the remake that happened in 2002-ish, they've got enough detail on the map there that you can actually see some of the locations. And so you've got Grafton, Franklin, Staunton, Roanoke, Gordonville. So, I mean, there's some of Lynchburg is on there. So some of the places where actual battles were fought are key nodes on that point-to-point map. I was kind of curious to see whether or not my thesis proved correct. So it's just the ones on BoardGameGeek are not super high res that you can really get in on the detail there all that close. So that makes it tougher. But Gary, you're on mute.
Who published the last version of A House Divided? Was it Phalanx?
Yeah, it was the Phalanx North and South game. It was called North and South, I think, is what it... Yeah. It was North and South. It was Phalanx. I think it was 02, but don't hold me to that. So...
Well, I was just curious. And honestly, it's not like it's something I would really want anyway. I really tend to prefer the hexes over area movement anyway, because I kind of prefer to have that alternate, you know, maybe the battle doesn't take place here. It takes place three hexes over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as somebody that does a lot of operational games, I absolutely prefer a hex map because it gives more freedom of maneuver. It can provide, an illusion of more freedom of maneuver than the historical commanders actually had. But, you know, that's why you play good games and not bad games.
Yeah.
Well, and at a certain point, some of that freedom of maneuver is taken away at the operational level just by the terrain. When you're in the Shenandoah Valley, you're kind of in a bowling alley, right? It's a little tough to climb the mountains on either side. So you're sort of stuck in the valley, and it's just a matter of how far up and down the valley you're going to have all those fights. So,
which actually makes it, you know, it's kind of like two armies fighting in a phone booth.
Yeah.
It's actually a fascinating operational situation. Stonewall in the Valley is the game on that subject at the operational level. And of course, Death Valley, if you want to play out the battles, a bunch of those battles are in the GMT's Death Valley.
Yeah. There's just only so far around the flank you can get when there's a mountain range in the way. So you tend to run into a hassle there. One of the things I wanted to ask before we start running out of time here, I'm curious because we haven't really mentioned them much at all, just briefly in one case, but Worthington has, and Columbia as well, have a whole bunch of different block games on the Civil War. And we haven't talked much about the block games that are out there. Well, you know, Columbia's had Bobby Lee and what's the Sam Grant.
Sam Grant.
They've had those in print forever. They wouldn't keep them in print if they weren't selling them. Worthington keeps reprinting their same Civil War titles over and over. They wouldn't be doing that if they weren't making money on them. What is it about the block games that, in particular, that you think attracts the audience, and why do they have the staying power that they do?
I'll let Gary answer that one because I have no interest in those games.
So this is a different question than Civil War, right? Because block games are their own thing, right? Both of those companies do block games on a variety of topics. And of course, Columbia Games is the company that pioneered the modern concept of block gaming.
Do they do anything that's not a block game?
Yeah, Harn.
Yeah, Slapshot, right?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, good call, actually.
In terms of the war games?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. So it gives you an easy way to model a number of things, including Fog of War and Step Reduction.
Yes.
That are just kind of turn those into tactile things that you do, that you face the blocks towards you. You take a step loss, you rotate the block to a lower rated side, right? So it kind of builds in very easy ways to model that. And so what you can get in a cleanly designed block game, and there are block games that I think are quite a bit more involved than that, you can get a lot of modeling mileage out of that. The Columbia Games East Front, West Front series, for example, has an HQ system where you actually use like HQ points to activate other units. And you those are your steps of the HQ. So you're activating two other hexes. You rotate the block twice because you spent two command points.
Yeah.
So you can get a lot of mileage out of those simple transformations of the blocks. For example, it's there's a lot more to it than just it's Stratego on a hex map.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But
the simplicity of that, I think, has an appeal for people who want kind of a detailed game without necessarily having to deal with detailed game mechanics.
Yeah, I guess part of what, you know, the fact that these same games have been in print for so long and continue to be reprinted, to me, it's got to be more than just they have blocks and other people don't. Obviously, if you're a block game fan and you want a Civil War game, there's a finite universe of those available. and it is much smaller than the available options for traditional hex encounter kinds of games. That's not a bold, you know, earth-shattering, unfair statement.
No, that's I think that's fair to say.
But we're not getting a ton of new Civil War block games on a consistent basis either. It's not like we're bringing out new ones to replace older ones that are then falling off the map the way we do with the Hex Encounter games. Did those block designs just happen to get it right? Or are we just, are the block designers too lazy to go back and relook at topics? Or are people just happy selling the stuff they know they can sell that they're not going to bother with the investment in time and design energy to build new stuff here?
So I'm going to answer that question with a question. Because I think everything that you said, there's something to that. But how much of the phenomenon that you're describing relates to the fact that the majority of block games are published by Columbia Games, and Columbia Games hasn't published a new design in years? They are, you know, my dear, dear friends at Columbia Games, who have been so kind, so very kind to me. But they, you know, they don't publish a lot of new stuff. So is it just an artifact of the way Columbia Games happens to do business? It might be.
Well, maybe, but Worthington publishes a good chunk of block games as well. And Worthington has published a bunch of new designs over the years, but they're
some of those games are not block games in the same sense that the Columbia Games block games are, like that new Tarawa, for example, or their relatively recent Chancellorsville game. That's a different mechanic than this just traditional block game.
Like Freeman's Farm, I think, because that one of them.
Well, yeah, but that's revolutionary,
but it's a, I think as far as style goes, I don't think it's like a traditional Columbia type block game.
I'm not sure. So just like we say, there's like a traditional Mark Herman-esque card driven design, you know, game mechanic that not every game that happens to be a card driven game uses.
Right.
There's that sort of a traditional Tom Dalglish block game mechanic that not every block game uses. And I think several of Worthington's games are those other kinds of block games.
Yeah. There's card-driven game with little letters on it that...
Freeman's Farm is another one, like that Chancellorsville game. That's I don't even think that's out yet, is it?
Yes, it's being reprinted as a part of the bundle that Worthington has on sale right now. Worthington's got a big reprint sale going right now with Freeman's Farm and I think Magnificent Style and something else. There's three games in that bundle that basically it amounts to a buy two, get one free, but you've got to order the whole bundle at once and you get three pretty substantial games, for a reasonable price if that's an area that you're interested in. Worthington's just trying to get them all into the warehouse right now. They're on a boat somewhere,
also known as the shed. I actually only see one Worthington Games title that's both a traditional block game and American Civil War, unless Lee's Invincibles and Jackson and Sheridan are block games too, and they might be, but there's like no pictures of them on their website.
I may be making a bit of an assumption on the Worthington Games types of games there simply because, again, it's not an area I'm as familiar with. We'll probably get all kinds of comments on this episode.
Yeah, those are block games too. What's more, those are operational block games. They're point to point.
Yeah. So that, not unlike Columbia's Crusader Rex and Hammer of the Scots, those are operational block games with point to point movement. So,
right. So there's more than I thought there was at first glance is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So is back to my original question, though, why are we seeing reprints of the same ones over and over instead of instead of any new designs, new battles, different battles? Why are we going back to the well of the same ones over and over? Are we just lazy, or the designers just given up? They don't feel like, you know, going back to designing more of those kinds of games. The audience just wouldn't support it if they tried. We clearly have an appetite for the American Civil War. There's a half a dozen to a dozen new Civil War games published every single year. What is it about the block war games that has those separated from that you know, new design space that we're seeing in the other areas of American Civil War game design?
I think they're two completely different questions, actually. There's not that many new block. I mean, how many companies are publishing block games?
Yeah,
I think three, it's just maybe three. I mean, well, every once in a while, GMT will do something that's like a real block game and not Commands and Colors, like Fields of Despair, for example, or Crown of Roses. Those are like real traditional block games. Europe and Asia and Gulf, those are as well. And those are out of print and have been out of print for years. But otherwise, I think it's a function of what designers are interested in. I think the people that are designing that like to design block games are doing block games. Or in Tom's case, he's busy running the company. But Grant and the Wiley boys are doing, you know, they're doing a variety of different games from Worthington. And some of them are block games and some of them are Civil War games. I think the question of Civil War block games is a smaller space than we imagine. I mean, I think there's probably 10 total. Right. So I think that's probably a category that I'd be reluctant to draw any sweeping conclusions from. You know what I'm saying?
Well, but I guess what I'm getting back to in that case, though, is that those things don't, if they go out of print, they don't stay out of print for long, because Bobby Lee and Sam Grant have been around for 25-ish years.
Easily. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably more. We're still printing them. And so clearly there is a fandom there for those games that, you know, again, maybe it's what you said is that, you know, Tom's designed those and he's busy doing other stuff. And so we're not getting any more designs along those lines, but there seems to be an appetite for these. Why not see more of those block games rather than just the same 10 over and over, get it constantly getting reprinted? Whereas in the Hex and Counter space, we're not necessarily seeing the same ones reprinted over and over. We're constantly seeing new and different ones.
Is that just a function of the number of new block game releases per year, though? Probably. What I'm asking.
Yeah,
because there are not that many. Let's not forget Craig Basink, who's done stuff for Columbia and now has done stuff for GMT as well. Conquest and Consequence just released Triumph and Tragedy, which I've played, which is wonderful. Those are traditional block games as well.
Well, and the guys over at Vento Nuovo have some the block games there.
That's true too. That's good call.
But a bunch of Italians designing American Civil War games, I would find a little odd anyway. So it'd probably do something really interesting with it, but I would definitely characterize them as a bit on the odd side. Were they to, you know, were a bunch of Italians to decide to tackle the U.S. Civil War.
What I'm asking, I think, is the question we are kind of asking here is it's about block games more than it's about Civil War games. There do happen to be a number of older Civil War block games that appear by all accounts to have been successful because they're still around and still get played. I think that's just incidental. I think that's true, but I don't think that we can draw many conclusions from that.
And that may be, and it may be one of those cases where the population of block games is so small that, you know, conclusions about one of them are not necessarily generalizable to the entire population. So that's entirely possible. In which case, squeezed 15 minutes of podcast content out of an indeterminate conclusion here.
Yeah, we have no idea at the end of the day what's going on. But I mean, there's certainly a lot of people that like operating in that space, right? I mean, Triumph and Tragedy is on its third printing now?
Yeah, so, at least.
And just got us, I think it's third, and it just got a sequel. And you know, I'm damn tempted by that too. I just bought them up games this month, that's all.
You've got to wait until your current postal carrier retires before you do that again. Before you start ordering too much more from somebody. Ah! Mike, you mentioned Jeff Davis might hit the table soon. You've obviously got another P Ridge comparative game to take a look at. Anything else from the Civil War that you might get onto the table and push around anytime soon?
The only thing I can think of is I would like to get Ben's earlier Civil War game on the table, the smaller one. It comes in one of those little, I don't think it's the little tin boxes that Fiery Dragon used to put out, but it's just a small box, not a very big map. So I'd kind of like to get that one to the table. And I would love to, at some point, do one of the big Civil War games, like the Civil War or the U.S. Civil War. I just don't know which one would be the best best game to do? It's, and it would have to be something I'd have to do on the side because it's going to go on forever and ever and ever. But which one would be the best for doing sessions and recording and playing it out?
The one that would work best is the one that you can get Gary to play on Vassal with you, so that way you don't have to lose a table to leave it set up.
Yeah, but see, I want to leave it set up on a table.
Well, okay. I can't help you with that part. So, Gary, we all know about your OCS addiction. You are quite proud of it. But are there any Civil War games likely to hit the table for you anytime soon?
If we're talking soon, as in like the next, say, 2 months, probably not. But because the tables are all spoken for, either OCS and the next other thing we're going to drop on a table is Pacific War. Yeah. But after that, I do intend to get more great campaigns of the American Civil War to tables at some point this year. That is a series I played some of last year, but not as much as I wanted. And I want to make sure that it hits the table this year.
Yeah. But by tables, we're sort of putting air quotes around tables. I will accept a multiplayer Vassal game that gets, you know, saved.
They can be virtual tables. I'd be comfortable with that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and actually, generally speaking, the Vassal modules for the great campaigns, the American Civil War games, are really good.
Yeah, I know you're addicted to Vassal as it is. Have you played any of them on Tabletop Simulator, or how do the modules compare between the two? If you have,
reasonably sure they're not on Tabletop Simulator.
Oh, okay. Well, then we'll skip that question altogether.
So irrelevant.
Yes, fair enough. I know that our buddy Cyrano has played a variety of the Forge of Freedom minis rules on, or not Forge of Freedom. That's the Matrix.
I thought we weren't supposed to use foul language on this show.
Maybe it's a crucible of something or other. They've done a variety of Civil War minis games, and I'm holding the air quotes around minis on
Tabletop. I'm holding the air quotes around games.
The reason I'm holding the air quotes around minis is that the Tabletop Simulator minis in question actually look like Tabletop Simulator Legos, which I find hilarious. It's like watching the Lego Movie goes to the Civil War. It's pretty damn hilarious. These are on Cyrano's channel. We'll link one of them to the podcast episode for people to take a look and wonder why we're playing with Legos and calling it war games. So
you guys are weird.
Yeah. Brant, I will pay you to go to Disney and pitch the Civil War, the Lego Movie. I as long as I'm in the room when you pitch it, I want to see that.
You can go to Microsoft and pitch Civil War Minecraft.
I'm going to just go ahead and say no now and save everybody the hassle. So because if they were going to pay me for it, I would just want payment in multiple $6,000 a night stays at that Star Wars Edge of the Empire experience thingy that they've got. That's like $6,000 a night for you to stay there at Disney. So guys, it's been a fun conversation. There's been, you know, honestly, I was a little more involved in the whole Civil War conversation than I thought I was going to be, given that it's not an area that I generally play a lot of. But that's fine. I'm happy to probe the depths of y'all's knowledge on these things as it is. I will say one of the more interesting Civil War game experiences I got to watch at Buckeye Game Fest 06-ish, maybe. It was 06 or 07. I remember Dave and one of the other guys had 3 days of Gettysburg set up.
I knew you were going to mention that, actually.
Yes.
It took them longer than 3 days to play, didn't it?
No, it took the 3 days. I swear that game moved in real time, is what happened.
They were doing very well then, because I've played that, and it moves damn slow.
Yeah. They may have had multiple people playing each side just for the sake of pushing the counters around in a reasonable amount of speed. But I swear, you know, look, it had to take 3 days, because back then Buckeye Game Fest was only 3 days long. And I swear that game moved in real time. It was kind of fun to watch unfold on the tables next to us. I spent most of it. Steve Busey and I spent most of it either playing Panzer Leader remakes or playtesting some of the old Warfighter series stuff. It was a good time. Like, I had fun there. It was a blast. That was back when you could still have an auction at Buckeye Game Fest, mm-hmm. and Bruce was quite the entertaining auctioneer. He was always fun doing the auctions. But yeah, that's one of the ones that I remember looking at that and going, that's why I don't play Civil War games.
So you're saying that when I actually run Victory Games, the Civil War, it's okay if I finish within 4 years.
Sure. Yeah. That's what you want to do.
That's my goal.
That game moves pretty fast. I mean, if you're playing at a convention, you could finish it in a couple of days, 2-3 days.
Well, if you're recording sessions for your channel on YouTube, it may take a little bit longer, especially when you have other games you got to do on the side.
Hey, Gary, thank you for joining us for the season 8 premiere. Really appreciate you being here. I'm sure we'll have you back later in the season.
Sure.
I'm sure we'll find some absolutely batshit crazy something or other in the wargaming world to bring you and Jim back to yell about and then cause all sorts of reactionary YouTube videos from other people.
Oh, that's always a great show too.
Oh yeah. It's it'd be all kinds of fun. And Mike, thank you for being here. You'll probably be back next week. So it's not like it's going to take us that long to find you again. So
my goodness. All right.
And audience, thank you for, you know, joining us for the premiere of season 8. As a heads up, we've got all kinds of crazy stuff coming up. One of the new things we're going to be doing. So up until now, most of the folks in the professional and practitioner world that we've brought on the podcast before have been sort of friends of the Dragoons, kind of, you know, either loosely affiliated members of or immediately adjacent to the regiment here with, you know, folks from our Origins crew or people that work with those guys. It's kind of cool. We've actually now gotten to the point where we have some folks from some of those professional organizations reaching out to us to say, hey, we'd love to get on the podcast with you this coming season. So we're going to have a couple of those coming up and continue our overlap with the professional and practitioner series. I'm sure we're going to have Rocky back in here at some point. And I'm sure at some point we're going to do some sort of just completely madcap off the wall, a RPG sci-fi goofiness, something just really out in left field kind of episode as well. Cause we can't help ourselves. But in the meantime, Monday nights, go watch Gary's show, 8 o'clock Eastern, whatever time other bastardized time zones you guys watch in and always jump in the chat on those.
We do Gary, not support Brant's EST chauvinism.
Yeah. Gary, what I know that you and Dan have had to rejigger the schedule for the Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Wargaming show. When is that one on now?
That is now on Tuesday evenings at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time.
Okay. And that one generally only runs about an hour, right?
We've occasionally run a little bit over, but generally we wrap that thing up in an hour. But it's always a fun show where we talk about hookers or something like that.
And if you haven't seen it, we've got a link to our site. If you haven't seen Dan's interview with Steve from Blue Panther from back at the ACDC, you absolutely need to go watch that show. That's a good real interview. Yeah. Dan and Steve were a perfect match for that because they both enjoy being kind of goofballs a little bit and they were to perfect effect. It really is a fun show. You learn a lot about Steve's business and how Blue Panther does things and why they're a great company to go support. And Dan's always a riot to watch interview people. Mike, what's coming up next on My Own Worst Enemy now that you've wrapped up the Cross 5 April's Pea Ridge?
The next game that I will do is actually a Civil War game, but it's the English Civil War. It's Cruel Necessity will be next. Hmm.
Okay, outstanding. So again, audience, thanks for joining us. We appreciate all y'all being here, and we will catch you next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.